was a bit of a wartime secret. 50 years after the fact, a book was finally compiled on Hawaii's shuffleboard pilots. Cam Napier is a contributing editor to HPR. He's also the editor-in-chief of Pacific Business News, but he also was an author. He helped to compile stories of the war effort by Hawaii's young women all across the state.
I was part of a small team of three people that worked on a book way, way back in about 1990, 1991, called Shuffleboard Pilots, A History of the Women's Air Raid Defense in Hawaii from 41 to 45.
So explain the title.
Well, Shuffleboard Pilots was kind of the nickname for the wards, the women's air raid defense. So I don't know if you've seen like World War II movies where there's a big room with a table-sized map of an area, in this case, the Hawaiian Islands. And around that table are all these ladies in uniform with headsets, and they have these long sticks that they use to move little flags and little wooden ships and things that stand in for aircraft. So they're called shuffleboard pilots because they would be moving these little symbols around on this giant tabletop map, which sounds very simple, but what they were doing was a very essential thing. I should probably back up. So radar was still very, very new, right? And when a radar operator looked into the scope, this is not like what you see in the movies today, and there's no GPS. All you would see would be a little squiggly line, and if the squiggle was really big, you would know that you're getting a large signal, either big aircraft or a lot of aircraft, and you would know what direction they were coming in. So there was a very limited number of people trained on radar at the outset of World War II. They were moved to advanced areas, so there was a shortage locally of plotters and interpreters that could interact with the guys at the radar stations who were seeing the squiggly lines and calling in information to Fort Shafter on what they were seeing. And so they realized, the Army locally realized that they needed some help. And so they created this top-secret, uniformed civilian service, the Women's Air Raid Defense. And they started out by recruiting local women and also wives and daughters of military families, because immediately after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was huge evacuation. So a lot of the military folks, they were sending their families away. Well, the military was sending their families away. It wasn't people individually choosing that. So for some people, when they heard about the opportunity to be in the wards, it was an opportunity to stay in Hawaii. And for other people, it was an opportunity to serve and have an adventure and help out. So that's, in a nutshell, what the wards were and why they were called as a nickname shuffleboard pilots.
Now, we did have one of our listeners call in to talk about his family's memories with the war. And he was talking about, I think, his mother and his auntie, who I believe were mentioned in your book.
That's right. That's right. That was Phyllis Dang, right?
B Wing, yes.
Right. At the start of the war, there were 6 radar stations in Hawaii, and they were scattered throughout the islands. And, you know, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the first information center was set up at Fort Shafter, so the wards were stationed there first. But eventually, they needed information centers on all the islands. And so very quickly, going into 1942, information centers were built for Big Island, for Maui, and for Kauai. And on the neighbor islands in particular, very much it was local girls, very young, even in high school, you know, being tasked with this very important job. One difference for the neighbor island ladies is that they got to live at home. You know, the Fort Shafter wards lived in a dorm that was built on base. For the most part. And if they lived on Oahu otherwise, they could go visit. They can leave the base and visit. But they couldn't talk about what they were doing. It was a classified job.
Right, kind of like Bletchley Circle.
Kind of like, yeah.
Yeah, so Phyllis Dang, I guess, you is from Kauai, and there's a segment in your book where she talks about what she did, right?
Right. So it was that same job So if you see them in the photos, the women around the edge of that giant map with the headsets, they're listening to the guys that are at the radar stations who are sending in, they're calling in information on what they're seeing. And, you know, there was a lot of fear that there would be a second attack. There were other smaller attempts, nothing on the scale of Pearl Harbor itself, but I think there was a midget submarine that shelled the Big Island later in December, for example. And until the Battle of Midway, when the war turned around, and it was after that, it was pretty clear that Hawaii was safe, even if the war was not over. Tensions were very high, and any sign of an aircraft that people didn't already know what it was and where it was coming from would be cause for alarm. And,
yeah,
everybody
would
be jumpy.
Air
raid sirens would go off, and all of that.
And so how did you get involved in this project?
Well, I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I was in college still at UH. I was an English major, and I was working at the USS Arizona Memorial as a civilian I worked for the nonprofit that supported the park. It was called Arizona Memorial Museum Association, or AMA, back in the day. It's Pacific Historic Parks now. And the museum curator at the time, Bob Chenoweth, knew some of the women from the wards, and they had just a wealth of material. They had diaries and journals and scrapbooks and photos and all of this that they thought would make a great book. So Bob and his wife at the time, Candace Chenoweth, they started working on this project and brought me in. I was very lucky to get involved with this. I was just an aspiring writer at the time. And so I got to take a look at the raw materials, the primary documents, and try to craft like a first draft of everything that would summarize the highlights and find the really good quotes that we would keep in like first person, and then summarize things. And then Candace whipped it all into shape. I was a rough young writer at the time. Well, very wordy.
Did you have a legal pad or typewriter?
Well, it's funny. I bought my first computer ever to work on this book, a little Mac Classic. Prior to that, yes, I used to write everything longhand and then retype it. I had one of these little typewriters that wrote on like thermal paper. Do you remember
yes,
that
yes,
weird in-between
yes,
technology?
I remember
yeah, yeah. It was, strange. Isn't
yeah,
it?
My times have changed,
yeah.
Right?
Now the fashionable thing, people are collecting old manual typewriters. I'm kind of interested in that myself.
Classics are all
classics. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, now, when you were reviewing this book again, I'm sure it jogged a number of your memories and the stories that you put together.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a peak experience, the wartime experience, and the women look back on it with a certain fondness, you know, for the intensity of the experience. They're very young. Some were single, some were married.
But imagine there's a pride, too.
And
I mean, that was
certainly
their war
effort. Yeah, a great deal of pride. And, yeah, it's something that it's hard for other experiences in your life to top an experience like that. Even sometimes in terms of tragedy, like one story, even without reviewing the book after all these years, that stuck with me was that one of the wards was married to a pilot on the Enterprise. And he came back wounded. And they did not get along well during his visit. They were arguing about, he wanted her to evacuate and get to the mainland where it would be safer. And they just did not connect, and parted kind of awkwardly. And he went back out on the Enterprise, and the next time the Enterprise came back, he was not on it anymore. He was killed in action. And so, I don't know, something about, you know, you ever hear that expression, like, oh, you should make sure you never fight with someone right before you say goodbye. What if you never see them again? And that's how you ended things, right?
Wow.
So something haunting like that. That's a story that stuck with me all these years is that example of being haunted by a missed connection.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that was for the 50th anniversary. We've just celebrated the 77th
year.
Yeah,
I'm a little blown away
by
that. Because I remember counting ahead and thinking, well, when the 75th rolls around, I'll be old.
Guess what?
And here, it just came and went. My goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can imagine then for the women and the families.
Yeah.
And just sharing that bit of history during that time.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then so many of our vets, like weren't able to make it this year.
Yeah.
Because they're all getting on an age, they're all in their
That's 90s. True. That's true. And people were worried about that even for the 50th. But there was definitely a sense for the 50th that would be, people like round big numbers. 50 is a mm-hmm. major number. So I worked out at the Arizona for 2 years. And the second year that I was there, I was helping out a man named Jim Harpster, who as a retired Park Service public affairs officer and also a retired journalist. He volunteered his time to help coordinate, I think it was 3 days of activities, commemorative activities surrounding the 50th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And, so I got to help him out, and at the time was helping with a lot of correspondence with the survivors and their families, people were trying to help bring in. And, you know, one of the things that Mr. Harpster pulled off was getting an original piece of classical music written to commemorate Pearl Harbor. He approached a conductor named James Duffy and said, I think it should be you. And Duffy thought it over and agreed. And one of the things that I did was, since I had worked with the museum collection, Mr. Harpster asked me to pull together materials from the museum that we could send to Duffy for his research. And one of the things that I did was I photocopied a lot of the letters home that were in the museum collection from sailors who perished on December 7th. And to my amazement, when this piece debuted with the Honolulu Symphony performing it at the Arizona Memorial, there is one of the four movements is called Letters Home. And excerpts from the letters are sung by an opera singer.
Wow.
And one of the letters is from a young man who died aboard the Arizona who had written to his mom to say, I think the line is something like, don't worry about me. I'm safer on this battleship than I would be driving my car back home. So very powerful stuff.
Yeah. And so 77, well, I wouldn't be 77 years later, but after so much time has passed, looking and thumbing through those pictures, anything else you're struck by now that you're old?
Well, I think, well, in one way, you know, the changes in technology. Even when I first was working on this book, radar and combat information had become much more computerized. And you know, you wouldn't have, even at that time in 90 or 91, you wouldn't have a room full of people on headsets moving pieces of wood on a giant map. But I don't think I ever anticipated that now you could have, like, that entire technology in your phone. So, like, if you use Uber or Lyft or something like that, and you look at the little map and you can see where your ride is on their way to get you, I mean, that's amazing. That's something that used to take dozens of people at facilities spread across the island, calling each other and saying what they think they see on tiny little scopes.
Okay, so big question. Is your book an e-book?
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's still in print.
Okay. Well, we'll have to
research
that,
won't it we? Was being sold at the Arizona Memorial Bookstore for a long time. And knowing that we would be chatting, I looked online and I see that you can find it on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com. So it's out there. And I think people would enjoy reading about it. It captures a whole different time in Hawaii's history.
So you can reflect on the war and reflect on the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Cam, for stopping by.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Cam Napier, PBN's editor-in-chief, who co-authored a book entitled Shuffleboard Pilots, The History of the Woman's Air Raid Defense in Hawaii, 1941 to 1945. We do want to share comments from our listener, Sherman Wing, who suggested the story and whose mother, Bea, and Auntie Phyllis were handpicked by the wife of the local Baptist church minister. Because they weren't allowed to talk about what they did for the military, he emailed, "Many thought the hundreds of girls there were used as prostitutes. My mom, in a sassy way, would say, 'When the flyboys got lost, we brought them home.'" He says his mother became an officer in the Air Corps and was also known as a slave driver. He added, "When the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor celebrations happened, my mother's unit was invited to march in as an honored guest." And we lead you out with that musical piece, John Duffy's Letters Home.